Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. In his reshuffle earlier this year, Malcolm Turnbull abolished the new portfolio he'd created of cities, previously held by Jamie Briggs, and instead he brought the area under his own department. He put in Angus Taylor, one of the up-and-coming members of the class of 2013, as Assistant Minister for Cities and the Digital Economy. Cities policy is an emerging debate as our urban areas expand, with all the challenges that involves. As we move to the election on July 2, we're joined by Angus Taylor to discuss the issues in his bailiwick. Angus Taylor, what will be the policy debate on cities in this coming election campaign? What are the main partisan arguments in this area, or is it a largely bipartisan area?
Well, Michelle, to some extent that remains to be seen. I think there is it's very clear that there's some agreement on what the problem is here. And certainly in our view, the problem is pretty clear. We have rapidly growing job centres in our CBDs. That has a good side to it, which is that those CBDs are great engines of economic growth and innovation and prosperity. But with that comes some challenges, and they include increasing problems with housing affordability, particularly as you get closer to the CBDs, an increasing need for more density as you get closer, more housing and density as you get closer to the CBDs, big challenges with moving commuters each day from where they live to work, because those distances have increased as more and more of the jobs are in our city centres. And meanwhile, if you go to the regional cities, which is a big part of my portfolio and an important focus, the challenge for some of those cities at least is jobs growth, particularly in areas where we've seen decline in mining investment in recent years, like the coastal cities of Queensland. So they are the problems. I think we can agree on much of that. I think where there is potential for difference is in the way we go about solving it. We take the view that there needs to be agreement across all three levels of government on how to solve those big problems. And we have already said that we're going to use the mechanism of city deals, which is an agreement across federal, state and local government on a strategy for each of our individual cities, recognising that no two solutions will be the same. We also take the view that we're going to need to find innovative ways of financing increased investment in our cities. Our view is that this will require a range of different mechanisms. There won't be any one solution, but we won't be able to finance the very significant investments required in our cities just on budget. We'll have to look off the budget. We'll have to look to use our balance sheet. Increasingly, we're seeing around the world very clever ways of making use of both government and private sector balance sheets to invest in increasing our transport infrastructure, but also encouraging more investment in housing and just as importantly, encouraging more investment in making our cities more livable, because we compete increasingly with cities right across the world in attracting people who can create jobs and in attracting organisations that will strengthen our economy and strengthen jobs growth.
Just to unpack some of this, you say that there's an increasing proportion of jobs in the centre of the city, but shouldn't planning be looking to having a fair proportion of jobs in the outer areas, in the rings around cities?
Absolutely. And as I say, one of the issues here, particularly in regional centres and outer suburban areas, is jobs growth. How do we get more jobs out of the centre? Look, planners can do whatever they like, but there are underlying market forces in our cities that are unstoppable. And one that's unstoppable is the attraction of being part of a very powerful cluster of businesses in our CBDs.
Has this changed?
It has changed. So we are, if you look at the numbers, and the numbers aren't as good as they should be, we're seeing CBD jobs growth of 5 or 6 or 7% a year, when the overall jobs growth in the economy is closer to 2%.
Why is this, though?
So I think it's to do with the nature of work and the nature of the industries that are growing in the economy. We are continually moving away from the old manufacturing and agriculture-based economy to service-based economy, and more of the jobs are at the very skilled end of that service economy. And, of course, those jobs tend to cluster in areas where there are like organisations and like skill sets. And so this is a challenge. But, look, there are great opportunities to break this in places. And we've seen right around the world, you know, regional cities really succeed. What were traditionally thought of as second-tier cities growing very, very fast. And you see this in the US, you see it in the UK with, you know, cities like Oxford and Cambridge, and you might say they're special cases. They are to some extent, but Bristol and in the US, places like you mightn't expect, like Oklahoma City or Denver, what were traditionally second-tier cities really growing. And we also see new areas in cities growing, so the Docklands in London, for instance. And this gives me great hope that we can actually find jobs growth outside of our traditional CBDs, and that must be a focus. One very early opportunity for us is Badgerys Creek out in Western Sydney. Western Sydney needs jobs growth, and we see real potential to grow the number of jobs out around that Badgerys Creek area, as well as Parramatta, closer in, so that people have shorter distances to commute to get to work.
So is this a matter of governments, the various levels of governments, providing greater facilities to attract employment? Is that what you're talking about?
That is definitely part of it. And we know new airports are great opportunities to do this. We've seen this in many other countries around the world. Badgerys Creek is important, I think, more important for jobs growth than anything else. We can create an effective jobs cluster around the airport. We know about 200,000 people net, 300,000 people in total, commute from Western Sydney to the east to get to work each day. We'd love to balance that up so that there will be many more jobs created out in that Western Sydney area. That reduces congestion, it reduces time to get to work, and that improves everybody's lifestyles.
Now, you spoke before of the need for cooperation between the three tiers of government. Mm. Do you think that that is really a practical proposition, or in some areas will you find local government difficult, or more particularly, I guess, some state governments difficult?
Well, always there'll be some who are more cooperative than others, but I think the incentive here is that if all three levels can work together, we can get better outcomes. We will work with state and local governments if they want to. If they don't want to, we can't force them to the table. But I think there's a very, very strong incentive here. You know, and I've seen it in my own electorate, where we get federal, state and local leaders working together in an alliance strategy, frankly, the sky is the limit. You can achieve an enormous amount. But they do it voluntarily. There are no conscripts in this process. The idea of city deals is that all three levels work together towards a single coherent strategic plan for that city. It's new in the sense that it's saying the federal government is going to be more focused on location-based policy. Infrastructure policy is location-based almost by definition, but we don't think about the broader consequences on jobs, on housing, as well as on transport. And by thinking about those broader consequences, I think we can drive much better policy down at the local level.
Have you had talks with state governments, and have you got any indication of cooperation in specific terms from any states yet?
Yes, we have started talking with states, and we'll continue talking with states over the next little while. There is a very strong desire, I think, from states to work with federal government for these sorts of outcomes. This hasn't been the focus of federal government policy in the past. And so I think I have been surprised, perhaps, that the level of willingness from state governments to start working in this way. Perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised, because it's in their interest. And they know that places like Western Sydney need a very sharp focus from federal, state and local government if we're going to solve the problems that we see there with congestion, with distance to work, and with the sustainability and livability of the new suburbs emerging out there.
You spoke also about financing, yep. Public-private financing. Can you give some examples of where that's been very successful overseas, sorts of projects, places?
Yeah, look, so it's fascinating if you look at the history of this. There was lots of this that happened back in the late 19th century. The railways in the US were developed this way. What's interesting is we've seen a re-emergence of it in the last couple of decades. And I think much of this is about stretched budgets. We're seeing that governments are finding it harder to finance infrastructure, and the infrastructure gaps have got to the scale now, got to the size now around the world where we've got to find innovative new solutions. So, for instance, in Hong Kong, a company called MTR has used development of railway stations and buildings and job zones and commercial developments around the railway and residential developments around the railway stations to fund the railways. We've seen in the UK a significant rail project there, cross rail project that again is financed effectively through value uplift in the land in order to pay for the railway. We're seeing in the US innovative approaches to financing infrastructure through mechanisms like TIFIA, which provides commercial financing to major infrastructure projects. So this is what you're seeing is a proliferation of new ways of financing infrastructure worldwide. We are starting to go down this path here in Australia. We're certainly going to be encouraging it in the coming months and years.
So how does the private enterprise get a return on this investment?
Right, so
Is it pays or...?
Well, look, there are many sources of return on transport infrastructure, potential sources of return. I mean, one is the fare box of public transport. You know, whether it's trains or buses, and that's an obvious one. A second is tolls, and we already have significant toll roads. We're not proposing to massively increase the number of toll roads, but that is already there as a mechanism, and we use it to some extent in this country. A third is revaluation of land, and we see very significant upward valuations of land around railway stations, for instance, when they're established. Japan Rail is using this very effectively as they expand high-speed rail into new areas in Japan. So they are all established mechanisms for sources of revenue, if you like, from which transport infrastructure can be financed. Those revenue streams may come well after the investments have been made, so you've got to provide finance, and that finance can come from the public sector, but it can also come from the private sector.
It's a bit hard, though, as you say, in stretched budget times, to even find partial financing from the public sector when we're looking at budget repair.
Well, look, I don't want to give you a detailed thesis on sort of public accounting, but it is always easier to finance, provide access to the federal government balance sheet if there is a return attached to it, because it doesn't need to be on budget. Mm. And, you know, we've been doing that to some extent with the NBN, or to a significant extent with the NBN. We can do it also with transport infrastructure. But that means the project has to be a good one. It's a project that's got to deliver a return. It doesn't need to be a huge return. But, you know, just as important, we need a public return from our infrastructure projects. And we're looking more and more to say, if we are going to invest in a road or a railway, we want to see new housing developed. We want to see new commercial developments and job zones developed. We want to see appropriate changes in planning, zoning, in order to get those outcomes. And so both commercial and non-commercial returns are going to be much more of a focus in the way we make our investments in coming years, and we're working closely with state governments to do that.
There was a story recently about the very fast train project. It seemed to come out of nowhere. People said it wasn't particularly an authorised government leak. Where is all that up to? We've seen this over the decades, people talking about that project. It's never materialised. Mm. The costs seem enormous. Mm. Do you think in your lifetime you'll ever see a very fast train?
I don't know, Michelle. I do think we're going to see more rail projects succeeding, and we're investing in rail projects, whether it's Gold Coast Light Rail. We're investing in work now on the Melbourne Metro. Will intercity rail work in this country? Well, look, what's clear is that taking aeroplanes out of the sky won't be the way to do it. If it is to succeed, it'll be around regional development. And that means land value uplifts in the cities through which high-speed rail goes. Now, could a Sydney to Newcastle, Sydney to Wollongong, Sydney to Goulburn, Melbourne to Shepparton, Sydney to Canberra, could any of those legs succeed on the back of land value uplift as a result of creating these fast rail connections? We have a committee set up looking at this now. And John Alexander is leading that, and I think
that's
that work needs to be done.
Federal government committee,
correct? What's parliamentary committee?
What's its remit?
Its remit is to look at innovative ways of financing major new infrastructure projects, and they are looking at high speed rail. Well, but rail is a significant focus of it, because what's special about rail is that it does have these very significant land value uplifts around where the stations are located. So that's important work. I was certainly very disappointed that the $20 million that the previous Labor government spent on high-speed rail didn't even give serious consideration to the land value impacts of rail. And, this is the key point about rail, is it does have land value impacts, and that's an important potential source of financing for these projects.
It's something of an irony, isn't it, that probably 100 years ago, there was a lot more freight carried by rail than there is now, when it's fairly minimalist through the country. Do you see any possibility of rail not just being for passengers, but making a re-emergence in the freight market, or is that always going to be confined to roads now?
Yeah, well, can I correct you on that? To some degree, what you say is right. However, let me give you a strong counter-example. Container freight from the east coast of Australia to the west coast of Australia, and bulk freight for that matter, typically goes by rail. About 80% of it goes by rail. So it can work from east to west. Where we've struggled is to get it to work from north to south, so from Melbourne through to Sydney and Brisbane.
And into the regional areas of New South Wales, for example, you see rail lines that have closed.
Sure, but a lot of that's about bulk freight and about grain handling. What I'm talking here about is where there's been great success in rail is bulk freight where there's high volume. So in the Hunter Valley and then in the Pilbara, we've seen very strong growth of rail. And on east to west, which is about 3,000 kilometres, it's long distances of container freight. Now, I think freight can work on rail, for instance, between Melbourne and Brisbane, and this is why we're focused on inland rail. We think there is real potential there. Right now, the modal share of rail is way below what it is between the East Coast cities and the West Coast. So there is potential there. Rail's effectiveness in a modern era is different from what it was 100 years ago, but it can work over those longer distances, particularly if we've got very good intermodal hubs. So it's very cheap then to move from trucks to rail and back to trucks or through to the ports. And those intermodal terminals are very, very important to the success of rail over those longer distances. But I think inland rail can succeed, just as rail is already a very, very successful mode between the East Coast and the West Coast of Australia.
Some Australian cities, Melbourne in particular, I think, have rated very well in terms of livability internationally in rankings. Do you think that when a city becomes very large, that it loses that livability quality?
That is the risk. What happens as a city gets larger is, as I said earlier, you're seeing more and more of the jobs in the CBD. They can be very exciting, well-paid, good jobs, and that's a great thing, and they trickle down too. There's lots of, semi-skilled and even unskilled jobs that flow from that, which is fantastic. But the risk is that as the city spreads out to accommodate that growing number of people who have got jobs, particularly in the centre, that we get congestion. We lose affordability, and we've seen signs of that in both Sydney and Melbourne and in other cities in Australia. So this is why I say that the answer here is to create new job centres where we can outside of the CBDs, and to improve connections between the suburbs and the CBDs whilst making sure we've got enough housing coming on close to the CBDs and further out as we need it. And if we can get all three of those policies right, and you know, we're investing $50 billion in infrastructure focused on these things already, then I think we can address those problems. But it does need proactive work from governments at all levels.
And, of course, you've mentioned regional cities.
Yes.
And presumably attracting people to those centres is another answer in taking the pressure off the major cities. But how difficult in practice is it to attract people to Bathurst or Wagga? Yeah. Or...
Well, you're not going to get Macquarie Bank to move from the Sydney CBD to Bathurst, but you will get other businesses. So I'm already seeing in my home city of Goulburn, many businesses moving out of Western Sydney, the more land-intensive businesses, whether they're in light manufacturing or logistics or intensive agriculture, moving out of Western Sydney and moving down to Goulburn. So you see, as the land values go up and as congestion increases in our capitals, the regional cities have much to offer. You also see that as people get a little older and they don't want to spend, it's still working age, but they don't want to be, carting families around for hours and hours on into Saturday sport, that living in a regional city can be very, very attractive. And if you look at a city like Orange, in New South Wales, I mean, it's grown very, very rapidly in recent years because it offers such a fantastic lifestyle. The challenge always is to get the jobs there, but we are seeing certain types of jobs moving into those regional cities, which are mostly growing at above the rate of growth in the overall economy.
So outside your electorate, not counting Goulburn, what's your favourite regional city? What do you think is the best regional city?
Always dangerous to pick.
I know.
To pick favourites in a job like this. But
give me three then.
Well, look, I think we're seeing a range of different things happening in regional cities. If you go up to the coastal cities in Queensland, they've struggled. They're struggling with the transition from the mining boom. But on the other hand, they have extraordinary opportunities in tourism and education. They're very attractive to Asian visitors and Asian students. They are facing really wonderful opportunities at exactly the time when they're losing some of their employment in the mining sector.
And what are some of those cities?
Oh, well, say if you look at Townsville or Gladstone or Cairns, really fantastic, or Darwin for that matter, really fantastic opportunities to our north, very attractive to Asian visitors, as I say, for tourism and for education. If you look at Western Sydney, and we might think of that as a city in its own right to some extent, it has great opportunities, again, in education, in health, in research, and Western Sydney University is a real cornerstone in achieving that. That's a suburban city, not regional. And then, you look at the smaller regional cities like Orange, I mentioned earlier, it's not in my electorate, has grown very, very strongly. It's got Department of Agriculture in there, but it's also had great success attracting entrepreneurs, small business people, and that's critical to success. Newcastle's done some very creative things in recent years in attracting creative industries into its main street, which was very run down. So we see a range of different examples of fantastic innovation, entrepreneurship, opportunity creation in these regional cities. And I think they're such attractive places to live now relative to the congestion we've seen in the capitals. They will continue to attract good people and great businesses.
The government is preparing a discussion paper on cities, I think.
Yeah.
Will we see that before the election?
Look, we haven't finalised the date. Certainly, you're seeing elements of it coming through every day now, and no doubt you'll see the paper itself in short order.
Before the election.
Well, the important point about what we're putting out is that it will focus on an integrated approach to our cities, and it will focus on finding clever ways of financing those strategies. And as I say, you're seeing more and more of that every day, and in short order we will see a cities paper.
We've spoken a lot about cities, but the other part of your portfolio is digital transformation. What are your priorities in this area? What are you doing?
Well, Michelle, the private sector has been going through a revolution in the use of information technology, digital technologies, to transform the way it does business, whether it's in not-for-profits or in for-profit organisations. Frankly, the government sector, the public sector, has been slower to adopt these technologies. And so the priority is to accelerate the rate of uptake of digital technologies by government. Now, we know there's a big prize in this. Deloitte Access tells us there's about $27 billion up for grabs just by getting the basics right. This is getting more and more people using web and mobile phone-based channels for things like accessing Medicare, accessing Centrelink, immigration, visas, etc., etc. And we know that as you get those digital channels right, people prefer it. They can use it any time of day. They don't have to travel. It's much easier. They've got better records, and they prefer it. So this is the focus in the short term. In time, I think that offers extraordinary opportunities for reform in the way government does business. So, you know, as we collect more and more data, we can engage citizens better.
It's expensive though to make that transformation. Well, isn't it?
You know, it's expensive not to, because the savings from doing this well, both for the citizens themselves and for us, are very significant. And if you look at the banking sector, and they're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but what they've done incredibly well over the last 15 years is use better these channels better and better. And you see, in fact, if people don't have to go into bank branches, they prefer it. They actually prefer having good digital channels. So it's very expensive for us not to do this.
I do remember at one stage one of the banks made quite a thing about putting in people back into its branches.
Sure.
I just wonder whether, with all the advantages of the digital connection for government services, do you lose some of the face-to-face feeling about it, people's need to actually connect with a real person if they've got problems?
Yeah, so people like using these channels for all their basic transactions. When a problem becomes very complex, then you're quite right, interpersonal connections are important, but you really only want that when the problem can't easily be solved by using a digital channel. But by making something digital, by putting it on the web or the phone, and we do this with our personal banking, you've made it, to do that effectively, you've got to make it pretty simple. And so really we want the interpersonal contact, and there'll always be some, to be for the most difficult problems, for the most complex transactions. And we know from experience outside of government, that's what people prefer. But look, the potential to engage people beyond just transactions is enormous. And we've seen, one of the better innovations of the previous government was with MySchools. You know, MySchools is extremely well used by parents trying to evaluate where they should send their kids, how their schools are performing. And in countries all around the world, again, we're seeing innovation in the way citizens can engage with government on driving improved performance in health, in education, in other services driven by government. And, that's the longer term benefit or bounty we get from digitalising government's activities.
Just to turn more generally to the political scene to finish up, you're in the electorate of Hume, which is a regional electorate. What sort of mood are you seeing on the ground? Are you seeing the sort of mood that is reflected in the opinion polls, or is your experience different?
Well, look, Hume actually extends from southwestern Sydney, now Camden, Narellan, Mount Annan area, right through to Goulburn and out to Boorowa towards Cowra. So it's pretty diverse. And you do see a range of responses to things. There's no doubt in my mind, top of mind for people is the economy. Jobs are important, particularly as you move out into the regional areas. But infrastructure is extremely important too as you go into the outer suburban areas, and for all the reasons I've already explained. I think people want to know that their government is effectively making this transition to a more diversified Australia. In the very agricultural areas, they want to know that agriculture has been given the support to succeed in an incredibly exciting environment for agriculture. Whereas if you go out to southwestern Sydney, they want to know that there's going to be continued jobs growth, and we've seen very strong jobs growth in that area, and that that the management of debt, the fiscal policy we put in place, is one that's going to be sustainable for these people and their kids. So there are a range of views, but I think economy is right at the heart of what people are concerned about.
Do you feel that people are disillusioned with the government, that they expected perhaps the change of Prime Minister to have more impact, bring more change?
Look, I think people have high expectations of any government, and rightly so. I mean, we have an important role to play. But they're also realistic. They know that that this transition is a tricky one for the country, but they want to have confidence that whoever is leading is managing that transition well. I'm confident that over the coming months in the lead up to the election, we can convince them that we do know how to manage that transition. We do know how to manage a difficult fiscal environment in the process, but most importantly, we do know how to create opportunity and jobs for families, for young people coming through. And we're certainly seeing in my electorate that job creation has been very strong in recent months and years.
You've come from a high profile business career to politics. What's been the biggest transition shock?
That's a good question. I mean, politics, there are many things that are similar. There's some things that are different. It is and has been a challenging time for Australia for really since the financial crisis, and certainly as the mining boom the investment has slowed, and managing that transition for Australia has been a challenge, and working with people on that has been important. But look, I'm buoyed by the work I do every day. I mean, Australians are realistic, they're pragmatic, the exciting thing for me in the work I do is being able to get out into the field, talking with people and solving real problems. And whilst I did that in business, I'm able to do that across a broader range of issues now than I ever was, and that's a wonderful thing to be involved with.
Angus Taylor, thank you for talking with us today, and that's all from the Conversations podcast. We'll be back with another interview soon. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins. I'm Michelle Grattan. Talk to you again very soon.